From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
This is just us doing our job. You know, we're making like it was really a special thing. This, for a whole year, the people of Illinois have been asking for us to do something. A whole year. And we have not.
This is a small step in the right direction. This is not a budget. This is not a balanced budget. This is not a solution to our long-term challenges. This is a bridge to reform.
This is a disaster. This is actually like putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. And it's going to make our problems worse. It's going to be more expensive to borrow. Those are going to be increased interest costs for the people of the state of Illinois, which will mean higher taxes. And we're going to have a complete crisis in January. And there are no reforms. This is a joke. There are no reforms.
This is a bridge to reform, a bipartisan bridge to reform. And the reason it was able to come together is both sides expressed willingness to negotiate further around reforms and truly balanced budgets.
We can come together. We can't achieve compromise. We can't pass a budget when the governor's demands relative to his personal agenda that hurts families are dropped.
Well, guess what? There is a state budget in place, sort of. Lawmakers and the governor got together on a partial spending plan. What will it do? And why did they come together now? We'll be discussing that on today's State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. And our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler. He runs the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also today, Amanda Vinicky, our State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio, Brian Mackey, IPR reporter, and Jamie Dunn, editor for Illinois Issues, also joins us today. Amanda, I'm going to start with you. You were following the action for the last couple of days at the Illinois Capitol, a partial budget. What do we mean by that?
What we mean by that is that it is not going to carry the state through all of fiscal year 2017, which begins Friday. Instead, it will just be enough to allow government operations to go through really the end of the calendar year. So through December, just past, the November election. And when it comes to other areas that are dependent on state dollars, for example, social service agencies, universities, it's a mixed bag. They also don't get a full year's worth of funding, but it isn't quite as easy to say when that money will run out in cases, and particularly when you look at social services, but also some universities, of course. They've been waiting so long for money throughout this past year when there was no budget. And by past year, I literally mean the entire year, of course, that though they're getting money, it's going to be, I think, a matter of just stretching it and plugging it in cases it is for the fiscal year that's just ended, in cases the money is intended for or at least earmarked as fiscal year 2017 dollars. But I expect, and the expectation is, that for many of these areas it's going to be a sort of triage and they'll just use the money wherever they can. So we'll see how long it lasts, point being that this is not, as you heard in the open there, a final solution.
Well, Charlie Wheeler, it may not be a final solution, but was this really a compromise? I mean, in the sense of both sides coming together, giving a little bit on each side?
Well, I think it was about the best you could expect under the conditions. A six-month budget is really not acceptable in the sense that to be able to plan, to be able to look ahead, you need to know what your resources are going to be for the full fiscal year. This is almost like a bridge to nowhere rather than a bridge to reform, because when they come back after the November election, they still face the problem of how do we pay for the spending that's authorized. And I think just about everyone who looks at it comes away with the conclusion we can't make the billions of dollars in cuts that would be needed to balance the budget. We're going to have to raise revenue from somewhere. And that appears to be the issue that people want to dance around, other than to use it as a political hammer to slam their foes. Oh, he wants a tax increase. We're going to need a tax increase. This maybe buys them time, as I said, to get by the November election, but it's really not much of a solution.
Yeah, Charlie, I hear you struggling to define this and say, you want to say, is it unacceptable? Is it a terrible idea to have a six-month budget? And I guess what, you know, the thing is this is relative to what we had last year, which was a zero-month budget.
Yeah, as they say, the best is the enemy of the good.
Yeah, so, and in this case, I think that we didn't want to let mediocre muddling by be the enemy of nothing and complete inaction, or when I say we, the state legislators at least. Yeah, nobody. There were a handful of people who, you know, seemed to be relieved or pleased with it. At least something got done. But most people were cautious enough to not thump their chests too loudly or pat themselves on the back for doing what probably should have been done and by all rights could have been done a year ago.
Yeah, and it's not a great thing, of course, to just have that partial year budget. But Jamie Dunn, this is certainly better than nothing for a lot of these agencies that are really teetering at this point.
It is, and I think the folks in the social services world, have mixed feelings about this because there are definitely agencies that would have been closing. We look at the United Way poll that came out, about last week, and a lot of the folks that they talked to said, another 6 months and we won't be here. Our doors will be closed. So it does, stave that off. But at the same time, and I think Amanda makes a really good point, a lot of those folks have not gotten any money for the fiscal year that's wrapping up now. So it's sort of disingenuous to say that this is a six-month budget for them because they're really just trying to, patch the holes and keep the boat from flooding from last year. So there's no way they're going to be able to make that money last for 6 months when they haven't gotten any money for the entire fiscal year for budgets that they did execute.
Contracts. I was going to say one of the brighter notes is that there is money in there for the operations of state government, stuff that wasn't already being paid under court orders or consent decrees or continuing appropriations. So, for example, the operations of prisons, and we're not facing the possibility of a prison riot when there's no food to feed the inmates. There's money in there to continue our road construction program, so projects across the state will not have to be shut down because there's no money to pay the contractors. So the ordinary day-to-day stuff of state government, the things that in normal times people would never consider, are going to be funded after having gone a whole fiscal year with no money.
Go ahead, Amanda. You were trying to get in there.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, you had asked about, is this a compromise? And clearly it isn't in terms of the overall scheme of things. You still had Governor Bruce Rauner after the fact talking about a, quote, grand bargain. And we can talk more later. He had a lot of interesting stuff to say about his hopes for what is to come going forward with the election in particular and its results. But is it a compromise? You did have both sides, in a sense, giving something up, taking it on the chin a bit, and nonetheless walking away with a win. So you look at Governor Bruce Rauner and Republicans who have been really, it seemed, trying to, foment a civil war almost light in the state between Chicago and all of the rest. And, going around in southern Illinois and saying Chicago's trying to get a bailout and it's your tax dollars, you should be mad. I'm not going to let that happen. And yet, lo and behold, Chicago Public Schools does get a pretty hefty chunk of money from the state of Illinois from both a new equity grant, but also for teachers' pensions. The state does, though, pay for teachers' pensions in every other district. CPS says it's only fair that you do the same for us. But part of that bargain, twofold. Number one, it's only for 1 year. It's not pension parity going forward. That, I believe, was an original incarnation of this legislation. Instead, amendment added just 1 year for this quote-unquote pension parity of CPS receiving $200 million. And that's not going to come in at all. That money won't flow unless, and this is kind of confusing, but it's where, again, there's the bargain and where the governor says that he can accept it, is because in order for that money to go forward, they basically have it set up. It's an agreement that though that money, that pension parity bill passed, it's going to be held. won't actually be forwarded to the governor, so the clock starts ticking where he has to either veto or sign it into law. Legislature says, all right, we'll work with you, we'll hold on to this until something that constitutes what the governor would deem reform of state pensions passes.
Let me pause for just a second and ask. I mean, to me, when I think about this, there's two ways to look at this. One is they can compromise, at least in some ways. They can come together and at least agree on a partial spending plan. On the other side of this, there are people out there who have been in lockstep with Governor Rauner, saying that he needs to hold out for what he wants. And I've got a feeling that they may not be too thrilled with this final product.
Well, I think if you kind of take a step back and look at it, as I mentioned earlier, the fact that there is now money to keep the ordinary day-to-day operations of the state going on without crises between now and the end of the calendar year is a victory for the governor. I mean, if there's a prison riot at Pontiac, as occurred, 30-some years ago, it's not the legislature that gets blamed, it's the governor. And so he's avoided that type of a crisis, or appears to have avoided that. So that's a victory for the governor. He's got the agreement that there won't be any additional state money going to the city of Chicago's public schools for the pensions unless there's some kind of legislation approved that would purport to cut benefits for retirees. Now, in my own mind, as I've said many times before, there's no way you can do that constitutionally. You can come up with some scheme that would encourage a state employee like all of us to give away our pension rights in return for some other consideration. As I've said many times, if somebody offers me $1 million, I'll sign off on my pension. But to imagine that there's going to be something that you can force on unwilling people or something that people will accept voluntarily that will save you $1 billion, I don't think that's realistic. But we're all going to pretend that it is so that we can get by the election, basically. And the money going to Chicago is not true parity. The legislation also allows there to be a property tax increase outside of the tax caps to fund teachers' pensions. Elsewhere in the state of Illinois, for every school district outside the city of Chicago, in the suburbs and downstate, the state pays the full cost of the employer's share for the retirement system. In Chicago, the state's going to, for 1 year, put in what, $100 million, $200
million? $200,
yeah. Yeah, which is, maybe a third of the overall cost? So it's not true parity, but it does set a precedent that we are willing to treat Chicago as we treat every other school district in terms of pension funding.
Brian, Charlie mentioned the election there. Is that really the impetus here? Is that what led to this? These sides getting together, working something out?
Well, that's certainly what you're hearing from a lot of legislators, that there was basically everybody's looking ahead to November. We already have seen advertisements and robocalls particularly aimed at what the Republicans think are vulnerable Democrats, or at least Democrats where they think they have a chance at flipping those seats. Of course, this is going to be a difficult year for that given Donald Trump at the top of the ticket. A lot of people think, in Illinois being generally a state that trends Democratic on presidential election years, some of the pundits out there think that the Republicans have a more difficult road ahead of them. Of course, they do have a basically bottomless well of money to spend on that in the form of Governor Rauner and some of his allies. But getting back to your question about was the election the impetus for this, it certainly seems like it. We've seen newspaper editorials beginning to turn on legislators and not really picking sides either. They're just kind of a pox on both your houses. There was a big coordinated campaign, actually. Turns out it was probably a day late because it came the morning after. There seems to have been this compromise, at least in principle, reached. But a bunch of newspapers in Illinois had front page editorials, pretty rare thing, and even more rare. I can't think of a time when newspapers have coordinated like this with a singular message. And it began with a single headline, enough, period. And then the individual newspapers crafted their own editorials to say, Governor Rauner, House Speaker Madigan, Senate President Cullerton, Democrats, Republicans, fix this, do something. So certainly there seemed to be a lot of pressure building out there.
Charlie, can you remember any time that newspapers have gotten together like that?
No, I can't. And I guess it'd be fair to say my memory probably goes back further than anybody else on this panel. I can't. Now, I don't know maybe if there would have been something like that in World War II or World War I, something like that, but certainly not on a state issue.
At least they got together at least in some way here, because otherwise it would have been a Dewey defeats Truman type of thing.
Yeah, and most of the time, newspapers don't agree in the first place on editorial policy.
Yeah, no, and that's what's – I mean – and we did see – this has been an interesting – we're getting a little far afield from our main discussion here. But most of the newspapers in Illinois did endorse Governor Rauner with varying levels of enthusiasm. The Chicago Tribune went all in for him, for example, and still seems to be there for the most part, although they did deride this Band-Aid budget agreement. The State Journal Register also endorsed Governor Rauner when he was a candidate, although much more tepidly than most of the other newspapers in Illinois. So it is interesting to see the
Chicago Business seems to have walked back their endorsement.
That's right. Yeah, they came out within the last week or so saying that they basically, I don't know, regret is the right word, but that the governor had proved them wrong. So which, of course, prompted the governor to say they've always been a little bit more, quote unquote, collectivist of a business publication than some others.
There seems to be a lot of endorsements over the past many years here for governors in Illinois that people have regretted later in newspapers. Jamie Dunn, the governor talked at the beginning of the show there. We heard a comment where he was saying this is not a balanced budget. Can you explain that? I mean, I think people think, oh, they passed something, so the money will start flowing, everything's fine. It's not a balanced budget. This just increases the backlog of debt that the state is going to wind up with?
Sure. I mean, we already have a huge bill backlog. And, you know, keep in mind that this piggybacks on top of all of those court rulings that are still causing the state to spend more than we'll be bringing in. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens with using those as a device to kind of prop this up, because at some point that ruling that allows employees to get paid, there's some question about whether that will continue or a court might toss that out. If that happens, then we're back in a whole nother mess if that gets thrown out. So yeah, this is really just kind of a patch that will keeps some things going, but is not going to put us in a fiscally responsible situation. And I think we saw that pretty quickly, that a lot of the universities in the state had their bond rating downgraded right after this was signed, because the bond rating agencies know that this is not a balanced budget and it's not necessarily a long-term fiscally responsible choice.
Well, let me clarify just on that point. Is it a situation where if I've been owed a lot of money, like I'm a contractor with the state and I'm waiting on my money, I'm just going to have to continue to wait even though there is a budget? And then there's also those people that weren't authorized to get money because there was no budget. They will then be put in the pipeline?
Yeah, and I think Amanda may know this a little bit better because I think she talked with the comptroller some today. But, you know, I think we're still in the situation where the comptroller is going to have to look at what's coming in and prioritize and figure out, you know, who gets paid when based on how desperate their situation is. It's not like everyone's just going to get in the front of the line and get paid tomorrow because this happened.
Yeah, and right. There's two things at play here. One is there legal authority to spend the money for the comptroller to write the check? And the second is there money in the bank to cover the check? I could sit down and I could write somebody a check for $10,000 and it would bounce, you know, higher than the Eiffel Tower. And the state's in the situation that now there is the ability to write checks for folks who all throughout FY16 did not have that spending authority, but the money's still not there in the till, and the comptroller won't have the money to back up the spending without these bill backlogs until we get some more revenue from somewhere.
And one of those groups that's been waiting for money, waiting for their money, is lawmakers themselves, because their checks were basically put at the back of the line, back into that pipeline, and waiting to get paid when their time comes up. Some of them have been waiting a couple of months at least. Amanda, you've got some new information on that.
Well, yeah, you know, so it is that for the most part, all of these bills and the authority, once vouchers actually get sent to the comptroller's office, have to wait in that bill backlog. And legislators were put in that queue. They haven't been waiting the whole time, like some of these social service agencies or other vendors. But they haven't been paid since April. And it seems that that's been long enough. Right now, the comptroller's office says that it's paying checks and bills from April 25th. Legislators get paid at the end of the month. So it should be sometime early next week, the first week of July, that legislators get paid for their April work. Not, of course, May or June. And the comptroller's office says it's still, you know, making assessments in terms of how this is all going to work. For the most part, the typical priorities in other cases, basically how you have legislators justify this and say that it is, you know, balanced, and you have a briefing page from the governor's office that makes the point. And Republicans really went out there to try and describe this as affordable, doesn't raise taxes. All of the funding is available under current law, which they say has been their requirement in terms of any of the piecemeal budgeting that's been going forward, whereas you have Democrats' requirement for that being that it doesn't contain any turnaround agenda elements. So where it meets that standard for the GOP is that it, in case, uses a lot of money from special funds. So for those, maybe the comptroller's office is able to pay a couple of checks quicker than others. In others, it could be just as long of a time because they have to wait for money to accumulate in these funds before they can pay the checks.
Well, and yeah, and that's a good note, Amanda, because the social service folks, a lot of that money is going to come out of some of those special funds. So there's a possibility, like you said, that could get flowing a little bit faster.
Although my understanding is that the consent decrees get paid out of the state's main checkbook account. And so that stuff's going to be ongoing, and that's going to be a stress on the comptroller to have money to pay for other stuff.
Which, again, gets us back to, it is most very clearly a partial budget, and the governor says not even a budget, a quote-unquote bridge, on this issue of legislative pay, because I think that when we look at what is behind this, there is, of course, I think, a lot of public pressure, especially heading into an election. There was the pressure on the Rauner administration of, as Charlie noted, you don't want a prison uprising. He really needed government operations money, so they both got that. And then there's also this issue of legislator pay for some. I think you'll have critics that they don't deserve to be paid. They didn't do their job. And when you have vendors, social service agencies laying people off, folks losing their jobs, not getting the care they need, why should I feel sorry for a legislator? Nonetheless, this is, for some legislators, their only job, their only income, and that presumably was a pressure. And so at least this could get that going. We're not sure if the comptroller's office will make other arrangements. They're still deciding that. Part of this legislation, though, does, as has in previous years been done, say that there will be no cost of living increase for legislators, constitutional officers, and actually also state's attorneys, something that would otherwise have automatically gone into effect. They would have gotten a pay bump. This means that they won't.
Let me switch gears just a little bit here. Something that happened with this final deal that caught me a little bit off guard was the discussion on changes to state employee pensions, that there may be another effort out there. Can anybody talk about, and I know we don't know what plan might be floated, anything like that, but why did that become part of this temporary budget plan?
Well, even though that wasn't one of the more recent turnaround agenda items that we've been arguing about for the past year, the governor's agenda, he did start mentioning that within the past few weeks as something he views as critical. And it's certainly something that the bond rating agencies pay a lot of attention to for Illinois. And it's something that really animates people because it is a big, big number, $110 billion plus, I think, is the unfunded liability. And the amount of money the state has to pay every year is a significant amount of state spending in order just to meet the legal requirements that were put in place a couple decades ago to try to get to eventual funding of that. And, you know, it is on a path, as Charlie has pointed out before, to eventually be funded, although I think a lot of legislators say that, you know, that's money that they'd rather spend on other things or tax breaks or something like that.
You can argue
that's why
they spent it on other things. Well,
so exactly. That's why we're in the position we are, because for the last almost 100 years,
right,
with the exception of maybe the last few, we've spent it on other things.
Well, and this, just getting back to Sean's main question, which was what sort of plan is going to be established, the governor seems to be more enthusiastic about Senate President John Cullerton's plan that he developed with his one of his former general counsels, Eric Medair. It's this consideration model Charlie had mentioned earlier. Basically, without getting too much into the weeds of it, you know, the argument is – You're entitled to your pension benefits you've gained up till now, but future pay raises, those don't necessarily have to go towards your pension. So you'll have a choice. You can give up the automatic 3% increases of your pension every year after you retire, and then any future pay increases you get working for the state would count towards your pensionable amount, or your pension is basically frozen at the amount your salary is now. And even if you get a job where your salary is doubled, that wouldn't necessarily count towards your pension. That seems to be the plan that more people are talking about, at least the governor and Senate President John Cullerton moving ahead.
Although, well,
go ahead, Amy. I was just going to say they had a deal, basically, that they supposedly Senate President Cullerton and Governor Rauner said that would be a path forward, but it wasn't voted on at all. And the Senate President said that's because I can't get my senators to vote for it right now, at this time where you're trying to, you know, essentially they feel screw over unions. And further, there's this distrust, there's a budget situation or lack of budget situation. And so that was where the Senate President said, sure, we may agree on this, and yet that doesn't mean that it can actually pass. So this is forcing the hand that will pass, or who knows? It could be something else. There's no actual legislation. It doesn't appear as of course, you had these really brief talks in May when the governor and legislative leaders got together, and some days they'd have a bit of a positive thing to say, most days not so much. That was a marked difference from what this week was like, when meetings went on for hours, when there are reports that the speaker was, you know, animated and involved. Clearly, they did come out, like it or not, they came out with something, with an actual deal, but didn't have time to take care of, presumably, that monster pension question. But, Sean, that's where it is included, that we're going to, it seems, very much be hearing about this again, because the Senate President and Speaker are both from the city of Chicago, very much vested, of course, in CPS getting that money that is, quote-unquote, pension parity. As Charlie noted, not even all the way, but nonetheless, a big hunk of cash. So we'll be hearing more about it later. Not all settled.
Things for us to talk about in the future. That's good, I guess. Well, time now for our notes from the field. Charlie, let's start with you.
Well, one of the things that happened that was kind of lost in the shuffle of the temporary budget being approved by the governor was that he also signed into law legislation extending our medical marijuana program by 2.5 years. It also expands the list of qualifying conditions to include post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, earlier, a Cook County judge ordered PTSD to be added to the qualifying condition, so that part of the bill maybe wasn't all that significant at this point. But expanding the life of the program will provide some degree of certainty to the folks who are making investments, both in the cultivation centers and in the dispensaries, and kind of stabilize the program going forward.
Jamie?
Well, one of the casualties of the budget impasse, the State Museum, it has been revived. The State Museum, of course, is now allowed to charge a $5 entry fee, and the branch in Springfield is reopening this weekend. Also, Dixon Mounds is reopening, but they're going to celebrate that next weekend on the 9th so that they don't have conflicting events there. But a lot of folks in both of those areas will probably be happy to see those locations reopening this summer.
All right. That will do it for State Week for this week. Our members of the broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Vinicky, Brian Mackey, and Jamie Dunn. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org, and you can also find us on NPR One. Just look for State Week. The production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.